Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. So we're really deep into the libraries of X, and because this is a very modular design system that we use in Linux in general, but also on X11, there's just a lot of stuff that it's part of X. So I'm starting to whenever it gets to the point where I'm just doing a laundry list of pieces, bits and pieces that have no sort of connection to one another. They do, but there's no obvious connection. It starts to feel a little bit boring. So I'm going to kind of really hurry through the libx whatever section of the X folder, of the X software set. So the first one is libxcm. This is color management, or rather color. It's the color system, as a color server is the word I was looking for the X11 graphic display. This is an implementation of the net-color specification. And the idea here, as with so many parts of X11, is that the thing that you want to use on your X11 server doesn't necessarily need to be all in one place. And I've said this before, and I'm saying it again, and it is that this concept of just this massively distributed system that could get referenced from different clients, I think is just so far ahead of its time. I just don't think anyone was truly ready for it. And I think that the way that computers evolved, where actually we're not doing that many multi-user systems. I mean, we're doing weird implementations of it, but really what we're doing is single-user computers that are able to mimic multi-user experience. And that's just the way computers have gone. X11 couldn't have known that. So that's what we're left with, is these remnants of an expectation that never came to be. That's my opinion anyway. I could be wrong. I didn't work on X11. Who knows? Someone else might have better insight. But that's my interpretation of all these different components and how this whole library system is constructed. Next one is libxcomposite. It's a compositor for X. What is a compositor, you ask? Well, if you think about the word composite, I mean, it means putting a bunch of different things together as one. And that's what a compositor does for your graphics. If you think about old computers, you can imagine, maybe you've experienced, you open an application and that's your computer now. Your computer is that application. I mean, you look at your screen, all you have is that application. That is honestly how computers used to be a long time ago. You would launch an application, and now your computer is that application. When systems came out that started to provide like a desktop where your computer application was this desktop application where you would just sort of rummage through your files, that was kind of a big deal because it felt different. But even in those early days, when you launched an application, the desktop essentially went away because the application is full screen, and that is all you can do. There was no multitasking. There was no real ability to do that yet. I mean, there might have been a system that did something like that. It's probably the Amiga. I don't know. But that's, or was it the Amiga? Whatever that fancy one is that had the great graphics, the silver bowling ball that would reflect the floor. Whatever that was, maybe that had it, but I'm pretty sure that was the Amiga. But that was the experience of a lot of people. A compositor allows you to have a bunch of different applications open and displayed. I mean, the compositor doesn't do the, like, that it doesn't issue process IDs and things like that. But if you want to see two applications on your screen at once, maybe with one hovering over another, as it were, well, the compositor is the thing that makes it appear, well, that there are windows that are laying on top of your desktop, or two windows, one on top of another, and both of them are on top of your desktop. That kind of quote-unquote depth, that depth of perception is what the compositor does. And XComposite, for instance, there's a component in there, automatic shadow update. That's part of the deal. You move a window and it's got a little drop shadow to kind of separate it from the background, because otherwise it just all starts to sort of not blur together, but sort of blend together. You just kind of, it's harder to distinguish one from the other. A little drop shadow, that makes all the difference in terms of, like, again, depth perception. There's composite overlay windows. There's parent window clipping. Functions like that. Do man X composite. You'll find out more. But that's what that library provides. Next up, libxcursor. You'll never guess what libxcursor provides. Next up, libxdamage. There's the documentation on libxdamage is woefully inadequate. It was almost enough to make me just say I didn't know what it was. Forget it. But as I understand it, it's literally one C file. Well, not literally. There's one C file, and then there's, you know, some make files and things like that. So it's not that difficult to read up on. But you still have to know what the concept of damage is in order to understand what the heck is happening in libxdamage, or at least xdamage.c. So the concept of damage in a compositing process is when, as I understand it, and again, I've never used any of these libraries, so there could be nuances here that I'm missing, or I could just be completely misunderstanding the process. But as I understand it, if there's a portion of the window that needs to be redrawn, maybe you moved something over it and now have moved something off of it, maybe you've moved it off screen, now you're moving it back on screen, whatever, the things that need to be redrawn is called damage. That's it's signified by it is marked as damage. There's a damage notifier that calls out to your graphics server that alerts your system to redraw what has been what you didn't see before, what it didn't have to draw before. So that's what libxdamage apparently does. Could be wrong about the specifics, but that's what I'm gathering, and I don't think I'm too far off. There's a couple of, like, there's like some Perl modules and things like that that refer to this and actually have pretty good documentation. So I gather that that's what that is. Here we go. libdcmp display. Nope, I got it wrong. dmcp. Display Manager Control Protocol. There you go. This is the xdmcp. Well, this is the library that builds that protocol. In Keith Packard's words on x.org, the purpose of the X Display Manager Control Protocol, xdmcp, is to provide a uniform mechanism for an autonomous display to request login service from a remote host. By autonomous, we mean the display consists of hardware and processes that are independent of any particular host where login service is desired. For example, the server cannot simply be started by a fork or exec sequence on the host. An external screen, keyboard, mouse, processor, network interface is a prime example of an autonomous display. And as I've said, dear listener, this is the philosophy I'm talking about. Light years ahead of what anyone else was thinking about. Super, super progressive stuff. And arguably just over complex for how people actually use computers these days. I'm not saying that's necessarily true. I am saying that X11 is very complex. I will say that. Going on record, it is too complex. But you know, whether it's like, maybe maybe it has to be that complex to do what it does. Maybe it should be that complex. Maybe we do want that. I don't know, but I don't know. It seems like everyone's going to Wayland right now, and I'm not running Wayland on Slackware. I tried, but I couldn't get a display. Even in the Wayland Plasma thing, couldn't do it. I mean, I'm not on Slackware current, so maybe I'm missing out on the latest and greatest. But on my Fedora laptop, I do run Wayland, and it's fine. It works fine. It's great. You'd never know. You really can't tell that it's not X11 until you go and try to do something like X forwarding. But I mean, even that is probably possible. But even that, like, nobody does that anymore. And I know nobody is a big word, and it's not accurate. But by and large, I just don't think people are doing it. That's not the way we're computing. And believe me, I think there is there's a pining, if you will, there. I think a lot of us hobbyist Linux geeks, I think there's a good, and certainly the BSD geeks, I think there's a serious sort of pining for an alternate history, an alternate timeline of development where computing ended up the way we thought it was going to end up. And I'm not saying that it's a fight not worth fighting. Like, maybe it's worth doing that. And there are people who do. There are lots of people who compute exactly the way they want. And I think that's fantastic. And I'm not sure that I'm not going to do that eventually myself. I mean, there are lots of factors in the way that I think I prefer to compute versus what I think that there's really super easy, don't really have to think about support for what I can do on a computer. And those are two not always the same thing. So there are things that I think about a lot. And neither of them are off the table for me. And I think that something like X11, for instance, I mean, as it gets phased out, whether sort of, I guess, we like it or not, I mean, the development, the focus of developers is not on X11 right now. And once again, I mean, you kind of have to listen to developers, I mean, because they're the ones developing, in terms of where computing is going to go. And I guess where it should go. I mean, if people are saying, hey, X11 isn't worth maintaining anymore, let's switch to Wayland, that there's not really a way to argue with that, because, I mean, that's where the people have gone. I mean, the people, the developers, you know, if they're focusing on Wayland now, then that must mean that people have chosen to spend their time on Wayland instead of X11. So there are reasons behind that. Maybe they're not reasons that I like or you like, or maybe they are, maybe we don't even understand the reasons. Who knows? Point is, there's a movement toward Wayland. Like it or not, it's happening. Do you have to switch? Not yet. Not now. Not quite yet. Eventually we might. You might have to. I mean, I'll switch whenever it just drops in my lap. I don't care when Slackware switches to Wayland. I don't care one way or the other. It's fine with me. I don't seem to notice really the difference. But I might someday. I might choose to want to try something different. I don't know. I don't think I ever want to go to X11 again. Like, once I'm away from X11, I believe I will be happy that I'm past it. I do believe that it's over complex. I find it very clunky to manage. It's fine to use. It's just if you have to configure, if you've ever done an a zorg.config file, then just it is not easy. And there's just no way around that. It's tough. So I don't know. I get the complexity. I get the pining for sort of a specific way of doing things that maybe isn't the way that mainstream wants to do. And I think I kind of see both sides of that of that conflict, because on one hand, I don't like the way mainstream computing is going, or has gone, really. And yet at the same time, I don't know that I really liked the place that computing was. I mean, I didn't hate it at the time necessarily, but I mean, there's still a lot of room for improvement in a lot of the technology being built and being used. So can I have neither of them? Could I have that third sort of path of complete unknown? You know, the path that's just better than the other two options. Don't go back, but don't go forward in this direction. Go forward in a slightly tangential direction. And I don't know that either of them would necessarily involve a graphics server anyway. I mean, yes, they would have a graphics server, but I'm saying that I don't think that would be the deciding point for me. I guess that's where I stand on that issue, is that the graphics server actually, X had gotten good enough for me to just accept it. yeah, good enough. It's working. If Wayland is better and easier to maintain and is better for like modern technologies, then great. That's fantastic. I'm happy to use it. Either way, I don't like where computing was. I don't like where computing's going. I would rather it just sort of go down this different path. One that focuses on, you know, open source and on shared services and on self-hosting and things that really Linux has always been about. But that tide of centralized sort of control and ownership and Microsoft and Apple and Google and all these things, they just keep pulling computing in directions that just don't seem all that appealing. And I mean, all of that was to say that I'm going to skip some libraries. That's really what I was getting around to. So there's libx EVIE. It's an event intercept library. There's libxext, EXT, for something like extensions. Libxfixes, don't know what that is. Libxfont2, it's got something to do with fonts. Libxfontcache, got something to do with FC. Fontconfig. So yeah, I don't know what fontcache has to do, but it's got something to do with fonts, certainly. And then, of course, libxf. And I don't know what that stands for. It's worth pausing here for something. So XFT is actually kind of an interesting maybe example of how complex X11 is from a different perspective. So this is there's a subheading on freedesktop.org/wiki/software/XFT, and well, so the current version of XFT 2.0 provides a client side font API for X applications. It uses fontconfig to select fonts, and I switched virtual desktops on accident, and the rendering, and the X protocol for rendering them, the fonts. Okay, skipping down to a subtitle called, or a heading called, The Many Faces of XFT. There are three different, very different libraries named XFT. Of course there are. The original 1.0 XFT library shipped with X-Free 86, and that's worth mentioning momentarily, 4.0.2, and included a private configuration mechanism through the XFT config file. For X servers without the render extension, XFT 1.0 used core X fonts instead of client-side fonts. This was supposed to allow applications to code to a common API and run with all X servers. Early in the deployment of XFT 1.0, it became abundantly clear that another custom X-specific font configuration mechanism was a really bad idea. So both KDE and Pango ended up stealing pieces of XFT. Weird choice of terms there. Stealing. And free type 2 backends. Fontconfig was designed to solve both of these problems. The other problem in XFT 1.0 was the use of core X fonts when the server wasn't blessed with the render extension. And it goes on like that. I mean, a lot of the complexity here is only visible because it's visible, right? It's open source. You get to see all of the design, I don't want to say choices, because these aren't even necessarily choices in some cases. I mean, there are things that happened, you know, there were things, someone would develop one thing and someone else would develop a different thing. So someone else had to develop a third thing to unify the other two things that got invented, and so on. And I don't think that's super uncommon. I mean, heck, that's not uncommon among, you know, within the open source space anyway, because there's not a big central project manager managing, I mean, heck, in companies where there is a singular project, like a top, you know, someone at the top, even in companies like that, there's duplicated effort. So it's not, obviously it's going to happen in open source. And I think that X11 is just, it's been around for a long time. How long has it been around, you ask? A long time. In the 90s and early 2000s, what we know as X11 was called X-Free 86. That was the project that was driving really all, you know, everything with if you were looking at a graphical display on a Linux or a BSD system, I guess that's a big statement, like probably X-Free 86, because I don't know, to be fair. Like, yeah, okay, I won't say the majority, but I mean, that was a big deal, right? That was one of that was the project, essentially. And then at some point, the X-Free 86 project began distributing, this is just from from Wikipedia, began distributing new code with a copyright license that the Free Software Foundation considered GPL incompatible. So that was a big problem, and there needed to be a fork. The first fork was Xuvert, and then the x.org server also occurred, and most apparently X-Free 86 developers basically moved to x.org. So it's something like 33 years X11 has been, or you know, the X project, whether it was X-Free 86 or X11 or x.org, whatever, it's been around a long time, and it just has culminated, or it's accumulated, I guess, a lot of those little patchwork solutions that just kind of have to happen when there are a lot of people working on related technology. Okay, so I mean, it sounds like this whole episode just sounds like I just hate x.org. Again, I want to stress, I don't. I'm using it right now. It's fine. I love it. I really do. I honestly love X11. Like, I have no problem with it. It's just I acknowledge that it's a complex system. Next library is XI, which is the very, very abbreviated name of X input. That's what that provides, X input. So the fact that you can type and you move a mouse and stuff and have it talk to the X server, that's what that one does. After that is LibCinerama. It's XCinerama. So Cinerama is a technology in film that came out, I don't know, in the 50s or 60s, probably the 50s, must be the 50s. And the big deal about that was that it was wider screen than ever before. And if I recall correctly, they did this by using a 35 millimeter camera turned on its side. That doesn't make any sense. No, a 70 millimeter camera, but cropped down to a 35 millimeter frame, but on the top and the bottom. So it was basically letterboxing 70 millimeters, I think. That could have been that could have been like VistaVision. I could be wrong. Either way, big, big wide screen. So that the idea was that it filled your entire peripheral vision. I'm sorry, I forgot. I'm supposed to be talking about LibCinerama, which has really nothing to do with that. It's a play on that word though, Cinerama. So LibCinerama. XCinerama. This is the thing that can take two physical displays, like a monitor, the thing that you're staring at on your computer. It can take two of those and treat them as if though it was one thing. And that's why you have the ability to, you know, if you have two screens, which actually I don't, amazingly, you can take, you know, like a window from one display and just move it right over to the next one. Really convenient. Seems very natural. Seems like the obvious thing that you would want to do with a monitor or with a, you know, dual head setup. But I mean, and it is, but I mean, that's what LibCinerama does. So that's what that is for. Then there's the libxmu. That's the miscellaneous utility library. And these are just miscellaneous utilities that are not part of the xlib standard. And then there's libxp, which is something about a print interface for X11. Can I get through all of the... Yeah, I think I can, because I'm just going to rush through them. So then there's libxpm, which is a pixmap, xpixmap, xpm image file format. We've used some xpm, I think, in previous segments about, you know, little bitmap utilities. So I'm pretty sure that's not entirely new. I could be wrong about that. I could be thinking of like BPM and I don't know, other ones. But I feel like we talked a little bit about XPM at some point. Okay, so coffee very soon. But first, let's do one more. And that's libxpresent. This is, again, not terribly well documented from the man page for xpresent, which is it's a reference to X11 extensions xpresent.h, so a header file. From that, it seems like it is a thing. Well, I mean, all it says really is xpresent is a library designed to interface the xpresent extension. There you go. But there are two significant arguments that it apparently takes, which is the display and the window. So I'm assuming it's a library and some functions that figure out where a window needs to be on a specific display. That's what I'm guessing. I don't know for sure. I'm gonna go get coffee. You should get some too. Okay, I'm back. I got coffee. And this is coffee that I've made with my, like, proper sort of, you know, espresso maker, like the espresso machine, the thing that you set up and you put the thing in and you turn and steam goes through it, that whole thing. Because my desktop mocha, or not my desktop, my stovetop mocha pot, the espresso pot, has like the gasket. There's a rubber gasket and it has gone, it's been destroyed. It is just, it is worn down and it no longer does what it's supposed to do. And so I went online to buy a new little gasket. And I mean, understand, this is like I think it's a 60 millimeter in diameter, just a rubber ring. And you just put it in the bottom, or in, you know, in the middle part of the mocha pot, so that when the coffee is being pushed up into the top from the bottom container, but there's no, like, you know, it doesn't splutter everywhere except in the top of, you know, so it creates the seal, I'm assuming. And it just doesn't do that right now because it's all sort of corroded or whatever. And so I went online to buy a new one, and I think the ring itself was only 20 New Zealand dollars, which, I mean, literally half the price of a mocha pot right there. And then the shipping, bizarrely, was like something like $30 or something. It was point is, like, literally a ring, a gasket for my mocha pot was going to cost literally $50. And I could literally get a new mocha pot for that. And I just found that profoundly disappointing. So I'm going to have to locate a new gasket in person from a store where I don't have to pay the shipping costs, obviously. And I don't know when that's going to happen. So probably my mocha pot is out of commission for the foreseeable future. But I do have my standard, just normal espresso maker. And I've also got somewhere around here, I've got a metal plunger as well. And I just, for some reason, I can't, it's like in the back of a cabinet somewhere, and I can't find it right now. But I mean, heck, the espresso machine is not a bad option. It just takes up a lot of room on the counter, which is kind of why it's a problem. But it is good coffee. Very, very good coffee. Okay, so we're in the R section of this LibX. So LibX R asterisk, essentially. And we are opening up with a good one. This is a big one. This is a big deal. LibX R&R. Do not forget the name of this extension. And these are all extensions. Like, if you're not gathering that, like, these are what X11 considers extensions, a lot of these libraries, because there's the core function of X. And then there are the quote-unquote extensions that are located literally in X11/extensions, as you heard about the one of those header files. That's where they're located. That's where they come from. That's what they're considered. And like I said, it's super, super modular by design. And that's why we have so many libx whatevers to get through. But R&R is a big one. I remember this one. And maybe you do too, if you've been using Linux for a while. It first appeared in X Server 1.3, and I don't know actually when that was released. Let's do a quick search for that to see if we can discover. 2005, apparently. I don't believe it. I don't believe that's when that was. Maybe it was. I just don't feel like it was that long ago. I thought it was more like 2008 or 9. Oh no, maybe not, because Slackware would lag in a lot of the things that it includes. So maybe I'm not actually remembering the release of that specific X server, but maybe I am remembering the time that I got it, you know, the moment, or maybe I'm remembering when it kicked in. Either way, why am I excited about R&R? Why should you be excited about R&R? It's the resize and rotate library, or actually I think it's more complex than that. I think it called, yeah, resize, rotate, and reflection extension library. I don't know what the reflection is referring to, but R&R, resize and rotate, this is the extension that provides automatic discovery of resolution, refresh rates, things like that, of your monitor, plus the ability to configure outputs dynamically. Like, you can resize, you can rotate, you can move outputs around, meaning you have full control over your X server while your X server is running. That's a really big deal, because that means you don't have to go and you don't even have to configure your X, your zorg.conf in the first place. You can do, I mean, something has to, but you don't have to. A long time ago, not too long ago. Well, I guess it is long ago. It's 19 years ago. 19 years ago, you had to, and you know, like I say, not everyone got all the latest and greatest improvements right away. So it could have been, you know, more like 17 or 16 years ago, depending on what distribution you were running and what your experience was. But 19 years ago, when you wanted Linux to appear on your screen in anything but text, you had to investigate what your monitor was capable of, like the hardware. You had to know what that was capable of. You had to know the refresh rate of your screen. You had to know the maximum resolution that your screen was capable of, but also what the driver was capable of. And, you know, I mean, to some people, that's not a big deal. Like, some people, you know, I know video gamers who know the maximum frame rate of that their hardware is capable of, and what their refresh rate is. You know, like, to some people, that's not a big deal. But to other people, it is just not something that you think about. And to still more people, especially newcomers, it's something that you've never had to know even existed in the past. Like, hardware was just the hardware. You just plugged it into the boxy part of your computer, and it just worked. Maybe you had to install a driver, depending on your operating system, or maybe there was no driver because it wasn't made for that specific operating system, so you just didn't buy the thing. Point is, once you had a thing on your desk and maybe did something, like, you were done. You didn't have to, like, look up the technical specifications of that piece of hardware. But for Linux, you had to do that. And that was a real, I mean, that was maybe a make or break for Linux installation. And if not a break, then it was at least, it could have been a make or break for the distribution. I remember the days, like, my very first Linux install was, as I've said before, I'm pretty sure it was Mandriva 2009. It was the one with Matisse, I believe. It was an orange disk, came with Linux Format Magazine, just off the top of my head. Or maybe it was a blue disk with a yellow star on it, actually. One of those two. No, it came with a book. I got a book from a bookstore with a Mandriva CD in the back. That was the first one. Anyway, point is, and that one just worked. Like, it just magically worked because of all the extra things that Mandriva put into their Linux distribution. And then I tried, you know, something else, thinking, well, I'm an expert now. I did Mandriva. I can do anything, right? And it turns out that no, you can't. Like, some of them just don't, that you don't get graphics. Or you do, but they're at like 800 by 600. So you have to go in and edit the zorg.conf file. So anyway, libxr&r. Yeah, that's what it's called. Really a big deal, like a major innovation. And honestly, probably the thing, I mean, can I just say that it's probably like literally the extension that was that's probably responsible for Linux surviving during the early 2000s? I don't know. I'm making stuff up, but I mean, it was a big deal. I don't think, for instance, I don't believe Ubuntu could have gotten off the ground without that. libxr&r. Without that, I don't believe Ubuntu would have worked. People just still wouldn't have taken that desktop operating system seriously if you had to drop down to an XML configuration file just to get a desktop on a screen. Next up, libxrender extension. That's the rendering system for X11. Libx, well, res, it looks like, but it's actually res. it's a resource extension, X resource extension. We looked at the X resources. We saw some of those in resedit or resedit, but really resource edit because it's, again, resource. The next two or three, I don't really know a lot about, and I'm not gonna just sum them up vaguely because I don't know. libxt, that's the intrinsic X toolkit intrinsics library. Don't know what that really means. libxtst, that's X test and record or record. I don't know what those are. And then there's libxv, which is the X video extension, and that is that's an important one. It's got everything to do with like video, like a video stream. So let's see, X video extension. Yeah, XV provides support for video adapters attached to an X display. It takes the approach that a display may have one or more video adapters, each of which has one or more ports through which independent video streams might pass. And it has to figure out what kind of video signal it's receiving, NTSC, PAL, CCAM, whatever, and figure out how to draw that on the screen. So for video capture, video editing, things like that, XV is absolutely essential. So as you can imagine, that was something that when I was doing film as my job was kind of a big deal. Next up is libxvmc. That's like v as in Victor, mc, not to be confused with xbmc, which is the older version of Kodi. It was the Xbox Media Center, which I guess because it was developed for the Xbox originally, then it became, you could run it on, you know, anything. It was open source, so a lot of people did. It's since changed its names to Kodi. But anyway, that's not what this is. This is the X11 Video Motion Compensation Extension Library. This is kind of a big deal too. The video ones actually are appealing to me. XVMC would be, it helps your display draw, it accelerates the drawing of video. And as we all know, video can be quite dynamic. If you think about what a video is, it is a box full of pixels, and every pixel is probably changing 29 times a second. So that's thousands of pixels changing 29 times a second. That's quite intensive for a computer. And I remember the days when computers, like, you'd be editing video footage on a computer and you had to edit at, like, I don't remember the resolution, but what would it have been, for like 480 by 360, something like that? Which obviously, I mean, that's tiny, right? That's too small to be useful. Well, yeah, it was too small to be useful. You would edit at that resolution, and then you would export your project by linking your edit choices by the time code. You would export your project by linking your edit choices to the big footage, like the full footage that wasn't tiny, and then you would have everything edited at its original resolution, which of course back then would have only been like 720 by 480 anyway, or 526 if you cheated a little bit and used PAL instead of NTSC. I mean, for some people that's not cheating, but for the US that was cheating. It's very intensive, and it's gotten better, obviously. I mean, we can play HD video on our devices now, at least, but obviously there's always going to be progress in one direction. I mean, now they're going, like, what, 4K, 8K, things like that. Some people are doing that already, so, I mean, I'm not. I don't care about that, but it's non-trivial is what I'm trying to say. So let's talk about libxxf86dga. We've already talked about xfree86. What's DGA? Well, DGA is Direct Graphics Access, and this provides you with direct access to a frame buffer region, and mouse reporting. It can detect mouse position, things like that. So it's apparently used, at least Debian claims that it's used by games and emulators for games. I don't know why. I gather it's a little bit of like an SDL kind of framework, sort of like a bunch of tools that someone doing a certain task might need, and that certain task, in this case, like a little a game emulator. Yeah, you want direct access. You want to define a window and then say, let me take control of all those pixels in there, and let's draw pixels in this style at this rate. And when I click, or when I click a, you know, when I do input, detect that, and so on. So that's X386 DGA. Why is it X386 DGA? I mean, I'm assuming that's where it came from. Of course, X.org was sort of forked from X386, so not really sure like why this one retained its name, but I mean, who knows? Like those things happen. XF86, X386. We'll see more of that later in some of the display profiles. We'll see quite a lot of it later, actually. A bunch of stuff that I'll probably just kind of summarily skip over, like I have for the last hour of libraries. I know my definition of skipping something is not quite foolproof, but I feel like I'm getting through these things. So libx XF86 MISC is a miscellaneous X extension from X386. I don't know what it does. I don't care. Then there's VM, XF86 VM. That's not virtual machine. It's a vid mode. So I'm assuming it's got something to do with setting video modes for your monitor. And on a vaguely related note, I guess, maybe, is libdmx, which is the distributed multi-head X extension. Distributed multi-head. Multi-head is a head of a computer is what we call the monitor, the screen. If you are headless, you don't have a screen hooked up to your computer. Or rather, if you are headless, then you are hopefully a computer yourself without a monitor. If you're a human and you're headless, you're not listening to this podcast right now. Libdrm, I think we've talked about DRM before. This is the component, because I remember saying it's not digital restrictions management, it's just DRM, direct render manager. This is important because this, I mean, DRM is the component within Linux and BSD and so on, the kernels, to provide a way of communicating to a graphics processing unit, a GPU. So you need that. You want your display server to be able to make calls to a GPU so that the GPU can handle the really, really complex things like rendering the video very, very quickly at very, very high resolutions, or processing whatever kind of data. So libdrm is the kind of bridge between DRM and the kernel and the graphic server. Libepoxy is the OpenGL function pointer management library. So it does things like automatically initializing a GL function when something is in use. Compatibility with like GL and GLES, EGL, remember EGL, the eagle thing? GLX, WGL, all of that can be mixed in with non-epoxy GL. This manages all of that, all of those disparate things, manages it for the developer. They don't need to worry about it. And then there's Liberation Fonts, which is kind of where I'm going to end this episode. But Liberation Fonts, this is an interesting one. This is a cool one. And I've already talked about fonts in a previous episode, so I don't want to belabor it too much, but this is kind of a great example of, I guess, open source calling the corporate world's bluff. So I've talked about in previous episodes about how sort of the font licensing and the way that fonts are managed managed but not enforced, and then enforced when it's convenient, and so on. That kind of bugs me, and it bugged a bunch of people who were trying to assemble an operating system that didn't have to worry about silly things like that. And so someone sat down and figured out, well, we should just, and decided that somebody should design a font that's the same like width and height as popular fonts, as kind of like the de facto fonts that were in use at the time. And that way, even though you weren't using that font, if sort of like a computer thought you were using that font, the text would still look normal. It wouldn't be like shifted all over the place or scrunched up or too spread out. It would be exactly, you know, the same sort of layout. So this is called metric compatibility. And the three fonts in question were Arial, Times New Roman, and Courier New. So Arial being the sans serif, Times New Roman being the serif, and then the Courier New being the monospace. Those were the, you know, the big de facto fonts at the time. What are those, Microsoft fonts? I'm not really sure. I imagine they might be, or maybe they were just the ones, you know, maybe it's a mix. I don't know. But somebody needed to provide those fonts to operating systems that didn't have legal access to ship and then like resell or whatever those fonts along with their OS. And so Steve Matteson of Ascender Corporation and Pravin Satpute for Red Hat Incorporated came up with a font set called Liberation Fonts. So today, if you're using Liberation on any application such as LibreOffice or LibreOffice, other things that have fonts, I guess, like Inkscape, GIMP, you know, applications with fonts, Liberation is a very frequent auto-include on a Linux system. And the reason for that is because they, if someone is using Arial or Times New Roman or Courier New, which a lot of people do, because again, they're just kind of still the de facto, like those are the fonts that come with the computers. Before you install any other like graphics package that might have more, even more fonts, like those are the ones everyone kind of gets automatically. And so if those fonts are around and you're using Liberation, you'll barely know that notice a difference. I mean, if you're a font pedant, I guess you might, but most of us aren't going to notice the difference. It's a really cool initiative. This was done quite a while ago, and there have since then been lots of, you know, I mean, you can't look for fonts these days and not stumble across more free and open source fonts than you can possibly need. Like they're just all over the place, and that's a great thing. But Liberation Fonts, I mean, that was an innovative idea to kind of do a metric compatible font to kind of get around any kind of edge case of where, oh, you're not supposed to be using that font, you can't include that font in your OS. All of a sudden we care, you know, like we don't care where else those fonts end up, but not on your OS, because your OS might seem like it's a competitor to us, and so it's advantageous to us to suddenly care about the font license. So Liberation Sans, or Liberation Fonts rather, very cool package. Are they great fonts? I don't know. Yeah, they're great. They're fine. They tend to look a little bit plain, but I mean, then again, so does Arial, Times New Roman, and Courier New. I mean, it's just, those are the computer fonts, and that's fine. Liberation Fonts, very cool. Big fan. Love them. I have them on all my devices, I think, because they just end up being there anyway, and that's a great feeling. So I think that's about it for this episode. There's more libs to go. We're in Liberation, and you might think, well, then we're done the libraries, right? No, there's libevdev, libfontinc, lib, you know, we've got the whole lowercase alphabet to go, which actually isn't as long as you might think. Like, saying that out loud makes it seem really scary, but actually, like, on my screen, it's really only about 2 screenfuls. So it's kind of what we went through with libx asterisk over again, but with more variety, I guess. And no matter what, I mean, a lot of these do inspire thought. I don't know if they're interesting thoughts, but they do get me thinking about open source computing, and that's a good thing. Like, if I'm not going to get much out of like a library that provides input feedback, you know, I mean, like it's cool, it's neat that exists. Obviously, I like being able to input things into my personal computer, but there's not a whole lot to think about when you're talking about that. But some of them, surprisingly, you know, really make you think deeply about some aspect of computing that you don't typically sit around pondering. So it's an interesting exercise. At the very least, it's a really great exercise in sheer endurance. And we're getting there. We're getting through it. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening. My name's Klaatu. You can reach me anytime over email with feedback or comments, tips, or just to say hi, my email address is klaatu@slackermedia.info. You can also reach me on the Mastodon network, not klaatu, at mastodon.xyz. The show's intro and outro music is by Fat Chance Lester. You can find their music on bandcamp.com or on gnuworldorder.info. In the archive, you'll find a music directory containing the album from which this music has been extracted. Until next time, thanks for listening and keep the source open.
Data.